Hey gang out there, it's Rob from Building the Game. Listen, if you couldn't already tell from my voice, I got hit pretty good with the con crud from Gen Con, and I just haven't really been up to recording this week, so we don't have a regular show for you. Instead, though, we are going to give you here the recording we made of our first time game designers workshop panel that we did on Friday at Gen Con 2013. This is me and Jason and Grant Rodiek, Chevy Dodd, and Jason Katarski. A lot of good information on there. Hope you guys enjoy it, and we will be back next week with a regular show. Hopefully I'll sound a little bit better, and we'll be back in good shape. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.
No. Okay. So, get that back down here. Okay, well, so thanks everybody for coming to see us here. Welcome to the First Time Game Designers Workshop. My name is Rob. This is my co-host Jason. We run a podcast called Building the Game. Any listeners out there? A couple? Okay, great. Well, thanks for coming. We're both aspiring game designers ourselves, and we're doing a podcast that's kind of about the process of game design. And part of our goals for the podcast is that we want to try and as we learn, we want to be able to share that with other people. That was one of our goals here with this panel, was to have some experienced designers, some guys who are published and kind of know a little bit more than we do about what's going on, to kind of ask them their opinions and their feelings about design, and to record it. Let's see.
I feel like we need to compete with these guys in the other room. Maybe we should cheer or something.
Game design!
There we go. All right, so we'll kind of get started here. If you guys have a question, if you could come, please come up to the mic and ask questions so we can get it recorded. And we'll get this episode posted probably either this coming week or the following week, and we'll make sure you guys all know how to find us afterwards. Starting with Mr. Katarski here, would you introduce yourself and tell everybody a little bit about who you are and what games you've made?
Sure. My name is Jason Katarski. I'm from Flint, Michigan, and I released my first game ever. The first game I ever designed was also my first game that was published. It came out officially in March. It was Kickstarted a year ago. Gen Con, I was here demoing it while the Kickstarter was running. It was published by Dice 8Me Games, and it's called The Great Heartland Hauling Company. And 2 months after its official release, we're sold out of our first printing and working on our second. I also just had a Kickstarter for a small game with Sprocket Games. Michael Fox from the Little Metal Dog Show put it out. It's called Frog Flip. It's a dexterity game made of 12 cards and a little frog disc. So that'll be at Essen in October. I have a few other things in the works, but so far, that's what I have. So.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Grant Rodick. I'm from San Francisco, California. I've been designing board games for about 4 years now. My first game, Farmageddon, was designed... Well, not my first game, but my first published game, Farmageddon, was published last year by Fifth Street Games. Had a successful Kickstarter by my publisher. We're just about sold out of the first print run. We have a second printing on the way. Won a Parents' Choice Award, which was really cool. So that I can compete with Chevy. And I have a couple other games I've been working on. Two more that I'm looking for publishers on that are getting there, but other than that, haven't found anything quite yet. A lot of prototypes and a lot of bad games in between, but Farmageddon's my my big one so far.
Sorry.
I got this one, Chevy.
Thanks, buddy. I'm Chevy Dodd. I'm from a town in West Virginia you never heard of. Probably the only person from West Virginia at this show. I've been designing since 96-ish. I started a long time ago seeking publication and got really jaded by that process. Last year, my first published game, Scallywags, came out from Game Right. It's been going phenomenally well. And I actually didn't have anything ready to go, because people were wanting more games. And so I've been a year of furious design trying to get more stuff ready, and now I have more stuff in the works. But yeah. They might get one of Parents' Choice also.
Yeah.
And a few other things.
Cool.
Parents hate my game.
You mean being like a Midwest trucker isn't a good theme for kids?
I guess not.
Maybe Frog Flip will help you with that.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Well, so guys, let's start our conversation here about. And I'm sorry that I'm kind of sitting behind you here. We're not the best arrangement, so I apologize for that. But let's start by talking about kind of where a lot of things come from, which is the initial idea for your game. I'm curious about where your ideas come from, and you know, what advice you would have for these guys on trying to pursue their great idea, that one that they're just they know it's going to work. What do you think? Well, how do you handle that? Jason?
Sweet. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, sweet. I generally work, I'm looking for ideas everywhere. And I generally find ideas in themes rather than in mechanics and math. I look for unique things that you don't see a lot of. When I had thought for years about, you know, maybe designing a game someday, and kept making other people's ideas in my head. And just felt like, you know, I would just give up on it. And then one day something struck me about trucking, and I went and did my little search on BGG and found out there was only a few games about trucking, and it had been like 20, 30 years since one won the German Game of the Year award in the 80s. And so I thought, hey, I'll explore that. And I went to work and kind of explored the theme with some basic mechanics in mind. Okay, so I like card games and I like cubes. How can I make a trucking game that involves those? And that's what I did. Frog Flip happened after my daughter and I made an origami frog and we're flipping it around at a restaurant. And she started kind of saying, hey, let's play a game, and rolling imaginary dice. And I'm like, hey, there's an idea in that. And the idea of a jumping frog trying to hit targets came in, and that's what ended up being Frog Flip. So the other games that I've come up with generally start that in that place of a theme or some little inspiration that I then kind of explore and try to tie in different parts. So I know it's different for everybody, but that's generally what works for me.
Okay.
With I bounce between mechanics and theme, and then sometimes Bauza, the guy who designed Seven Wonders and Takedo and Hanabi, he said something like he doesn't really think of themes or mechanics, but he thinks of a story that he wants to tell, and that sort of resonates with me. But with Farmageddon, for example, this was 2 or 3 years ago now when I started it, and Farmville on Facebook was really big, and it was basically about planting crops and doing stuff, and I really didn't like it, and there's like 100 million people playing it, and so I thought, I want to make a game about farming. And farming to me has, if you look in the natural environment, you know, everything from beekeeping to cooking, there's a lot of natural inspiration and natural mechanical inspiration. And crops are about, you got to put something in, you got to wait somehow, you have to protect it and nourish it, you have to get it out, it's worth something when you get it. Those things just seem very natural to me. And then if you even look at words like crop rotation and irrigation and the Dust Bowl from history, I had a lot of inspirations from the ideas of farming. And I grew up in Texas, went to college in Oklahoma, so it's just something that's always been around me. And so I sat back and I knew I wanted to make a simple game because the game I designed before it was way too complex and it was horrible. So I was trying to limit myself to cards, limit myself to a short play time, limit myself to something that was accessible. And the mechanic of Farmageddon's key mechanic is you basically plant crops and you have to nourish them enough. Once you do that, you can harvest them. And I sort of abstracted that because in Zynga's Farmville, you plant crops, you have to wait long enough, and then they automatically harvest. And so instead of waiting for a time-based mechanic or having to count down rounds, I just decided that I would abstract it with, instead of investing in time, you would invest in resources. And so that's sort of where I went. With my war game, York, I like war games. I wanted to make a game about conflict. There's a lot of natural stuff that a lot of war games had, and I sort of challenged myself by picking out components and mechanics that aren't typical for war games. And so I said, I'm not going to use dice, and it's only going to be an hour long, and it's going to play with more players, and so little things like that. So goals, situations I like to play with, and usually some sort of hybrid of mechanics and theme. I like to get a little bit of both. Chevy?
Yeah, I'm all over the board, honestly. Like, whatever hits me that day is what I design. It could be a theme, it could be a simple mechanic, it could be somebody on Twitter saying, hey, I want a game about this, and I just go make it because I get inspired by it or whatever. So, I don't know. I like to make simple things that work well. And, yeah.
So I'm hearing from you guys what you're saying a lot is that you want to try and bring something new, because there's kind of most themes that are out there are things that people know about. So from all three of you, I'm hearing you say that you want to bring something new to these ideas. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
So, I think the thing is people, if they're ultimately going to spend money on your game, they need to feel like it's worth having in their collection and it's worth their money. And so most people aren't going to buy just another game that's, you know, Agricola with, you know, a theme about making sandwiches or whatever, you know, because people already have Agricola. Right. And so you need to twist it somehow. And I think there's a really cool opportunity right now to take classic themes and twist them just a little bit. You don't need to go too far off, because if you get too far off the beaten path, then it's uncomfortable. And people like the familiar, the comfortable. I mean, when you always scoff at, oh, zombies are selling. Well, people like zombies, and they make sense. And when you buy a zombie game, you know what you're going to get. You're going to be fighting a lot of zombies. You're going to probably die. You're going to escape from them. And that familiarity is really comfortable to customers and players. But you don't want to just go so far off the beaten path that they don't get it. And you probably also don't want to make a Euro game about zombie management. Like, you don't want to be like, well, I have to keep my farm precisely originated. I need three legs, and if I combine three legs, I can turn it up and then on the rondelle. No, it's not what people who want a zombie game want. So find out what you're trying to make. Find a way that you could twist it and take it 10 or 20% in a different direction, just slightly, and see where that leads you. And you know, I think that'll excite people to be like, oh, I really, that sounds neat. That's different. And it doesn't have to be revolutionary. It doesn't have to be completely unheard of. Just take it in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, I agree that familiarity was the one word that came to mind. Was you take those familiar things and just twist them in some way, because people can get into something if it feels familiar. And then the hook or whatever it is that thing that makes it stand out, that makes it a little bit different. And that's a great place to be.
Yeah, I actually started working on this medieval city building game, just generic, you're building buildings and they do things to help you. And I talked to this guy about it, and he's like, that's dumb, I'm not playing it. Like, why? And he's like, that's boring. Like, I've got 100 medieval city builders, make it about Vikings or something. And so I was just kind of being a jerk, and I was like, sure, it's Vikings, I don't care. Like, I put some umlauts on some letters, and there it's Vikings, so, you know. And then like 2 months later, all of a sudden I've got like boats and you raid villages, and now this theme drove the game. You could still be retheming it as a generic medieval city building game, but actually that theme kind of actually pushed the game forward. That was it's a pretty good moment, I think.
This guy. Yeah, I mean, with my war game, I was sitting there, I was inspired by generally the tactics of the mid-19th century and early 19th century, so like Napoleonic tactics, the Franco-Prussian War, sort of like, you know, horses, cavalry, artillery. But I didn't want to restrict myself to just like, well, the French hussars of the 8th Lightfoot Division had these muskets, and it's kind of boring. And so you could take a lot of things where you look at history or nature, and you sort of look at, well, what purpose does this serve in my design? What is this going to do? And so I eventually abstracted it to, well, I like guerrilla warfare, and I could take some of that. And I like, you know, more defensive, disciplined armies, like the classic British army fighting the Americans in the Revolutionary War. I'll take some of that. And you can sample and dab, and it doesn't have to be a precise simulation, you could abstract it and distill it, and you might find that you'll find neat new mechanics, because you're like, well, what does this ultimately need to do? How can I represent that in a different way? And that's something like a lot of Chevy's games do, is they take one really simple mechanic and they do something like Scallywags, your pirates fighting over your loot and how you do it, and it just starts with the notion of you're throwing it all on here and you're grabbing it before you even think about it. And just, it's a simple abstraction of, well, how would pirates go after their loot? Or how would, you know, a British soldier fight in this war? And it doesn't have to be perfectly exact to the history or the theme. You can abstract it here and there, and that's another way you can get variation and differences from what's the norm.
Now, we've hit one of the biggest questions is which is more important, theme or mechanics? And I always kind of feel like the cop-out answer is, well, they're both equally important. So maybe we can share some thoughts on that subject. You know, where do you start? How often do you start with one versus the other? Theme drives mechanics. Mechanics can drive theme. You know, how do those things interplay with each other?
Well, I have like an actual example. I made a game about racing dogs. don't ever make a game about racing dogs and tell people about it, because they will immediately tell you it's the most inhumane thing on the planet. And you get, and it's okay, so fine. They're robots. So that's my fix. So I go to this publisher who I thought, this guy's going to like robot dogs. And he goes, I don't want to do a racing game, and that's the only thing people bet on. And so I said, well, I'd really like to show you the game anyway. I just kind of pushed, and he was like, okay, well, you know, bring it to me and show it to me. So in the week before I got to meet him, I show up and I'm like, it's not about dogs anymore. And he's like, what do you mean? And I was like, we're shipping companies now. And we're space shipping companies, and you're not betting. This is cargo. And he was like, he got excited about it. Whereas a week prior, it was, I'm showing you this racing game and it's terrible. Now I'm showing you this cargo shipping game, and he's like, oh, this is really cool. I want to take this. Okay, you can have it, you know. So I think that's like, I don't know, that just changing, just switching, it's the exact same game. I didn't change any rules, nothing. I didn't have time. It was a week, you know. I just slapped a theme on it, said, here you go. And he was suddenly excited about it. It was his game now, you know, or whatever.
That sort of supports my argument. So I think they matter more at different times, and it's not... So I think theme is really important for getting in the door and getting your game off the shelf. You know, people are going to walk at the board game store, they're going on Amazon, and they see something, and they look at that cover, and they're going to judge your game by its cover, and they're going to be like, ooh, what is that? That is a story, that is an experience, that seems like something that is interesting to me, and then they're going to go further. Now, whether it remains in their collection, whether it's something they pull out for their friends, the mechanics really need to be strong there. But at the same time, if your game is like really abstract, or you have all these mechanics without a reason, you're going to find that some people have a really hard time connecting it, because they're going to ask, well, why does that exist, or why is that there? And if you have really natural thematic push for the mechanics, or you need a mechanic and you find thematic inspiration for it, if there's something that logically explains why it's in this game, why it fits the experience, both systematically and also thematically, that really extends the long-term life of that game, because sure, you're off the shelf, but you want people being verbal ambassadors, wanting to play your game, showing their friends, keep bringing it out. And so some of those games that really continue to deliver on the mechanics long-term, but also that they have that, it all sort of makes sense for what you're doing, that it really helps expand the life.
Yeah, you know, walking around Gen Con, you don't see a whole lot of just abstract game companies on the exhibit hall. And there's a couple, and they're really good. And there's people who go for that, but that theme a lot of the times seems to be a hook for people. And then the unique gameplay really, really helps.
Yeah, my friend Cole, if he sees a game that says Dungeon on it, he stops and looks. And if I see a game and see Dungeon on it, I actually go the other direction, because I have expectations for what it is, be it fair or not. And same, like, I don't really look at zombie games at all, just because I have an expectation. But for some people, they'll see that up on the banner, and they will go there first. And then you just need to maintain that and satisfy what they think they're going to get.
Now let's move on a little bit, and let's talk about it getting into making your first prototype. When you have that idea, how soon do you take it from idea to prototype? Mm-hmm. And along that same line, how soon do you start writing down rules? Because rules, in my experience, is a pretty intimidating thing to do. So how important is it to get that out early, or do you guys leave that to the end?
Chevy?
Yeah. Having the idea and making the prototype is the same exact thing for me. Like, it's immediate. There's no wait. I like to know if my idea works before I start working on it for the next 6 months. I could spend days and days and days abstracting that maybe this idea is going to be cool if I add this, but if I never play the game, I don't have any clue. So the very first thing I do is make the most bare-bones prototype I can and give the core mechanic a shot. And if the core mechanic works, I can build on it. If the core mechanic falls apart, then I have to rethink. Or I could have just spent 2 weeks of my life like ironing out rule sets and then playing it only to find out, hey, the core mechanic doesn't work. If I'd have tested that 2 weeks ago, I could have moved on. So for me, it's the idea and the prototype happen at the same moment. But then in writing rules, like, I'm really bad about writing rules. I have prototypes I don't have rules for, and I've worked on them for years. But then I'll go write rules, and while I'm writing the rules, I'm like, oh, I could have fixed this. You know, I'm like, I should have wrote these rules a couple years ago.
I'm a little bit different. I'll have an idea, and sometimes if it's simple enough, or if I get really excited, if it just comes to me, I can make it a little bit sooner. but is often the case in about 90% of the time, is I'll have my idea and I'm like, all right, I think I know where I want to go with this. And I will just sort of think on it, not like actively sitting at my desk, but I'm walking my dog at the park, I'm driving, I'm showering, I'm mowing the lawn, basically where I'm not thinking about. And then I'll get hit at some point over what could be days or months. And then once I have it, I sit down and I write the rules. I write the rules before I do anything because I want to know how I'm going to teach it to players. I want to think about how complex it's going to be. And, like, I need to figure out how I'm going to explain this, because if I don't think I can explain it to someone, then it's probably too busy. And it's also my... I work as a game developer for my day job. And so I'm from a background of we write designs and then the engineers code them and they have to understand what our designs were. So that, to me, is my training. And so I write rules first, and then it's really easy for me to maintain them. Like, every time I do a test, I'm like, okay, and I scratch off a line and add a new line. And I don't have that dreaded, like, 3-week write rules procrastination, because they're there. It's just a doc I keep up.
Yeah. I'm probably more like Chevy. I like tangible things. Like, I like to move things around. So I have an idea. Like, with Heartland Holland, for example, I just said, okay, like, I like cards and I like cubes. So, like, I went and got a couple decks of cards and a couple things that look like trucks and some things that could be cubes, and I cut up some cards, and I did all that. I just moved things around until it was a game, until I had a sense of what I was going to do. Because when you're making a game, you have an idea, and you're putting boundaries on that idea, right? You have a goal, and how do you get to that goal, and you have those boundaries. So I start with something physical as boundaries. And I can add or remove stuff later. But I move things around until it's there. And then pretty shortly after that, because I don't always finish a game, you know, on that first try. But I'll write down some notes. Or I'll sit down and start, okay, thinking out what a turn looks like. And taking those ideas and just sequentially writing them in order helps me fill in the gaps. So sometimes I get moving things around and I solve some of my problems as I'm typing out the rules. And I don't always, I come back to it. Like, I drive around and you think about it for a while, and like, I work on a game for a week and then I don't get to a place where I can test it, and I step away from it and I work on something else, and then I come back to it. And it's this start and stop process, and it's not very linear for me, but it usually starts with put the idea to work with something physical. And see where it goes from there.
Once I actually start, I was thinking that once I actually start and get it together, like, I don't do any thinking at that point. I just test and test and test and play. So once I actually get it down, it's all iteration at that point. It's almost mechanical.
I'm curious, guys, Chevy, you're prototyping so early, and so is Jason. And I think I fall more in line with Grant, where I write some notes down before I prototype. I'm curious, how rough are your first prototypes? I mean, what's your process for putting those together? Like, what are your favorite things to use?
My first prototypes, I couldn't play it with anybody else because they wouldn't understand my handwriting. Like,
so mostly handwritten.
I'm usually solo testing that very first go, and yeah, it's usually handwritten. Now, I've been working with, like, Inkscape for 6 years now, so I can prototype with Inkscape faster than I can prototype with my pen, but I'm like Jason. I'm very spatially person. Like, I don't sit down with spreadsheets and figure stuff out. I sit down with a deck of cards and I write numbers and I sort them in piles until it looks right, and then I shuffle it all together and try it. And so a lot of times it's literally a card with a number on it and no name. No, we'll just see what happens. So, but there's also prototypes that I've, you know, I do artwork and I have components ordered from the game crafter or whatever before I've ever even played the game.
Yeah, I did that. I did that once. I made the prototype. I actually paid a friend $50 to make the prototype before I played the game, and it's still sitting there in a box and never been played. But it looks really pretty. But generally, yeah. Like, have you guys ever heard of the game? I think Winning Moves or Parker Brothers put it out, or used to put it out. Flinch. It's a speed game, kind of like Ligretto or something, but it's unsuited cards that are 1 through 10 or 1 through 13, and they're all the same suit. They have a little fancy, like, frilly symbol in the middle. So every time I go to a thrift store and I see that, I buy it because it's a blank numbered card that has no color on it. So I make a little sticker if I need a suit and post it in the middle of it. I picked up some Uno game the other day. It was like Uno brand made it, but it was like a kid's game. Just a bunch of different colored cards. So I go to thrift stores and I buy a bunch of games that I'll never play, so I can keep all the parts on hand if they look interesting. And then I take those different parts and use them how I want to. Or I just use a standard, you know, deck of 52 cards or... I don't have...
Phase 10, man. Buy pallets of Phase 10. Just buy cases of Phase 10. Go to Walmart and just... They'll look at you funny, but you'll use those cards for the rest of your life.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really helpful stuff, because then I have a bunch of stuff to say.
I'll never play Phase 10, though.
Totally.
I like the salvage right there. No, it's really great.
Something I found with cards for prototypes...
I've enjoyed
it. I always use... I used to play a lot of like Magic and stuff like that, so I have all these card sleeves. So I just emptied them all out. And so I'll just print off in like Microsoft Word, I'll print off 9 cards on a page, cut them up, and slide them in card sleeves.
Yeah, definitely.
And then it looks kind of nice.
I do the same exact.
But it's fast.
My first prototype, I cut out half pieces of index cards. I cut index cards in half and then printed out the typed up piece of paper because I didn't think to get labels because I'm stupid. And then I cut those out and I glue stick them on. It took me like 4 hours to make every change, and my friends were like, my cards are sticking together. it was awful, but I tend to just do what you do, is I take either just blank index cards from Walgreens and I just scribble on it, and my friends make fun of my handwriting and they're like, is this a 4? And I'm like, no, that's a 12.
Am I going to win if I play a 4?
It's really great. It's what you need. And then sometimes we get really goofy names that we weren't expecting because they thought my handwriting meant something else. But yeah, because I do so much with cards. One tip I want to recommend is teacher supply websites are super cheap because teachers don't have any money, and you get really cool toy-like components. And I just bought, for example, a set of blank dice, but they have whiteboards on them, like dice with whiteboards, so you could like dry eraser marker. So if you want to make a game that like changes the numbers or changes the symbols, if you take a game idea from me, I'll kill you.
But they're like super cool.
Yeah, like little pop-up.
Don't go
dogs.
Buy those dice and use them.
You can buy like thousands of cubes. It's a good idea, but don't use them. but no, go to teacher supply stores. They have crazy cool stuff. It's very toy-like and weird.
My other one's business cards. My very first game ever was a complete inside joke. I stole a box of my boss's business cards, and I said, I'm going to make a game about you on the back of these cards, and I did. And then for years, like, I got into these jobs where I would change jobs, like, every 3 months and get, like, 5,000 business cards. And they're perfect, because you can shuffle them. They're blank on the one side. You just write on them and go, and it just works.
That's good.
So I still have boxes of business cards.
If you give him your business card, you're going to be in a game. He will never call.
Now, we mentioned some software, Microsoft Word, and Chevy, you mentioned something called Inkster?
Inkscape.
What kinds of software do you guys use to help you to do your designs?
Inkscape.
Okay. Can you tell us what that is?
It's literally the only thing I use. Inkscape is a freeware version of Adobe Illustrator, so it handles vector graphics very well. It has a lot of really weird nuances, and I've been asked to do some YouTube videos, so I'm working on that. I've said that for 2 years, but I'm seriously going to do it because it's a little goofy to work with if you want to prototype with it. But it does layout and stuff pretty well after you understand its nuances. But it also does graphics. Like I do all of my graphic design in Inkscape also.
I use Google has their Google Drive. It's their free open source. It's basically tied to Gmail, but it's basically their office suite. And so you can get basically Microsoft Word, spreadsheets for tuning and stuff, but they also have the best program they have it's called Google Drawing, and it's sort of like Visio or like really simple Photoshop, but you can like, I make all my cards there before I go too far, so I quickly just pull out a rectangle, throw out a triangle here, make the triangle red, just grabbing some clip art, and so I make all my card mocks like even like, and I'll then go scratch them in hand, but like to sort of get a feel for what the card looks like. So like I prototype a lot of my ideas before I actually test it, but I'll be like, alright, I think the card can look like that, and then I'll talk about it. But and the cool thing is if you're like, you know, on your phone, you can look at it and pull it out. Like I could show you right now my designs on my phone. I can go to work, and if I'm working, I can mess with it there. I can do it at home, and so it transfers between all my computers. And other than that, I use Photoshop when I'm actually like doing the actual cards and stuff.
Yeah, I generally do it in three phases. So I start with the really ugly whatever I have. And maybe I throw stickers on it or throw it in a sleeve, like you guys mentioned. And then I go into like Word, or I use GIMP. Depends on like how, which is another free I mean, you type in GIMP in Google, and it's like free. What is that?
Photoshop.
It's like Photoshop. Yeah. There we go. And
maybe type in GIMP photo program.
Yeah. Yeah, free GIMP, and I don't know if that'll be good. But so it's pretty simple. It's free. I'm terrible at it. I just built my first prototype by myself on it this last year, and it's not pretty. But I got the job done, and then I was able to order some parts off GameCrafter that were a little bit nicer, so I could send some halfway decent stuff that people didn't have to put out together for playtesting. And then my third phase is usually, and this is probably crazy because you'll hear a lot of people say, never spend money on art because your publisher is going to throw it out. And I have a friend who started a business, and a graphic design business, and I usually pay him a little something to give him some extra work, and I'm teaching him some of the game industry type stuff so he can work with more clients who do games eventually. But so we have this good working relationship, and he does like a prototype of so I can get better looking stuff done for me. And the reason for that is some publishers say it doesn't matter what your game looks like when you bring it to me, like, because we're gonna throw out your art and make our own anyway. But I want people to feel the feeling that I have in mind. I want to give a sample of the world that I'm trying to bring you into. I would never pay more than like $100 for something like that. It's really hard to do that, but I can't do it myself and make it look pretty. So, so that's my three phases. So ugly and workable until it's a little better for playtesting, and then when I'm ready to start pitching it for publishers, I might splurge for art or, you know, trade favors, appropriate favors for artwork. Yeah.
Another really good free site to use is game-icons.net.
Yeah.
I just put a prototype together on my way down here, and I used probably 100 of them, and yeah, they're for symbols. And they're just fantastic. You can't use them in your game, but you can use them in your prototype. Highly recommend that.
Or just tweet me. I get bored a lot, and I love drawing icons. I'm dead serious. Like, I really enjoy
it. You should start uploading those to gameicons.net, and then
yeah, you can do it for me. I'm too lazy.
Just send them all to me. I'll just use them.
Okay.
So obviously, there's no substitute for playtesting. How much playtesting do you guys do before you take that next step? Because obviously sometimes you make your first prototype and it's garbage, but you know what you need to do, mm-hmm, and you do some more testing and you do your revisions. But at what point do you say, I've learned everything I can learn from this version, I need to stop and move forward with that? Do you, even after you think you've learned everything you need to learn, do you keep on going just in case? Or are you kind of ruthless about that and stop every time and revise?
I often change almost every test, but I think I always typically move in the same direction. Like, I don't really spend a lot on, like you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think I'm just, like, grinding out like a bad... Like, I usually
make very clear goal
forward progress.
Start, right?
Yeah, I don't meander too much on that. But the only times I don't really change my design is when I'm at Gen Con and I'm stuck here testing and I don't have a way to change my game before subsequent tests. So I'll get, like, 5 or 6 tests on a build before I go home. But usually, if I'm really working on a game, I'll test it once or twice a week at work and stuff over lunch, and I'll change it almost every time I'll go home. Change, fix the cards.
Sure.
It's just bug fixing.
Don't tell the publishers. I playtested Scallywag once. Mailed it off. It's like winning the lottery. Seriously. I'm not even kidding you. I made 0 changes after that first playtest and started emailing people. And
don't do that.
4 years later, don't do that.
Terrible.
But at the same time, I have other games that I've worked on for years and years and years, and they've gone through so many variations that the result that I have right now doesn't even remotely, it might even be a new theme, new everything from the previous versions, and I could do that forever. But the stuff that I have, like, I've got 3 things on GameCrafter, and I'm pretty much just done with those. I'm going to continue to support them, and I have other ideas for them, but I'm not going to keep updating them or anything like that, because I just need to let that go. At some point, you just got to let it go. I mean, especially if you're going to seek publication, you have to understand that if you go to a publisher and you say, this is my game,
and I'll sell it to you exactly as it is, and you have to print it exactly as it is, they're just going to tell you to go away. Like, they're not interested in that. And a lot of it has to do with, like, legal reasons. They're buying the game from you, but really what they're buying is your rules. And if they don't put some of their own input into it, most contracts will have this cancellation clause, which means you get the rights to your game back. Well, if you get your rights to the game back and all they did was print your game, then somebody else can print that exact same game and it's no big deal. But if you get your rights back because of sales or whatever, the publisher fell through, then you can only go sell your original game. You can't sell the stuff that they did to your game. And so it's kind of like a two-way protection sort of thing. And so you have to realize at some point, if you're going to go publish, or somebody's going to publish your game for you, it's not going to be what you designed anyway. So just let it go, because they're going to develop on it. And it's okay to hand them something that's a little bit unfinished, because they're going to finish it. That's kind of what they do. And don't be afraid of it, but don't playtest it once and mail it off. That's really bad.
Yes. Sometimes I think you have a sense of, like, when, you know, like, when it's done. And some stuff comes together really quickly, and some, you know, like that one that I had the fancy prototype made of, and I haven't played it yet. I haven't played it because it's not all there yet. But other games have come together really, really quickly. And I like what Chevy said about, you know, like, you have to be able to let it go at some point. And if you're really lucky, when you submit to a publisher, that development process involves you and includes you.
Yeah.
And it becomes this kind of like, okay, I've went as far as I could go with this game, and I think it's ready. And then you get a new set of eyes with a person who thinks like a game designer, you know, who's working for a publisher, and they see some different stuff. And they say, well, what about this? And what about this? And they're bringing new questions that, like, you're too tired to see, or you can't see because you're so involved in creating your baby. So that's a really cool thing, because it helps you to go a little bit further if you get to that place where there's a cool relationship with your publisher where they want you involved in that process. So yeah, don't be afraid of it, because that stuff has made me a better designer. Working with Chris Kirkman at Dice Hate Me, like, his ideas have been really helpful. I've been designing a game with Philip DeBerry, and I thought it was done, and he's like, hey, we should work on this together. And I'm like, what do you mean it's done? Like, what could you contribute? And it's a totally different game. It's a totally better game now. And working with that other person has helped me grow as a designer too. Like, that collaboration thing helps me see in some new ways that I don't always see.
One more quick thing is that when you're iterating, make sure you have, like, a problem you're trying to solve or a goal you're trying to reach. Don't just change to change stuff and be like, all right now this is too powerful, right now this is ending too quickly. Make sure you're actually trying to address something, because if you just change stuff to change stuff, you'll kill yourself. Yeah. You'll do it for 50 years and your game will be terrible. Like, be like, all right, I have this problem, and solve them one at a time. Prioritize them. Be like, the economy is really important right now. I need to figure out the balance of that. Solve that. And then be like, all right, player turn order stinks. Fix that. But don't just do stuff to do stuff. Every now and then throw some spaghetti on the wall and see, like, oh, I wonder what would happen if I did this. That's fine. But, like, typically have a goal in mind. Like, you're trying to make a better game. You're solving a product. Focus. Go down the line.
Mm-hmm. Parker, from Pittsburgh. I have a question that's based on publishing and self-publishing. So, how much of a double-edged sword is Kickstarter these days? Because you have a recently Kickstarted game here at Gen Con. When I got the package in the mail and got everything that I wanted and started looking through the rules, and some of the rules were kind of fuzzy and stuff, so you have to jump on YouTube, find videos, stuff like that. After it's been played through once or twice, then these rules start to make sense. But really, if they would have spent probably maybe another month of working out some of these rules instead of coming up with additional bonus levels and stuff like that for members to try to drive up the price as much as possible, they could have probably be ironed out some of these things. Are these things that publishers could have handled, or are these things that, you know, maybe weren't properly Kickstarted, or... How much of a double-edged sword is
it's
that
honestly
for you?
Patience. I've been in this industry for 20 years almost, and Kickstarter is nothing new. It's just a new way of doing it. And there's been, I don't want to call them fly-by-night publishers because I don't believe that's what they are, but there's been this culture of, oh, this idea is awesome, I have to have it out right now since the beginning of time. And those are the games that do what you're talking about. from the time I signed my contract with Game Riot, it was 3 years before we published Scallywags. They went through 3 years of development,
it's
writing rules.
It's a 15-minute game.
It's a 15-minute game, and it took them 3 years to get it right. The current project I'm working on, it's projected for 4 years out of after we sign. We haven't signed. I mean, it's all like, you know, we're friendly working together right now. It'd be they would work on it for 4 years to get it perfect because they don't need the money. They have the money. That's not an issue. They need to make good products. So I don't know. Like, you have a good experience with Kickstarter. And I, you know, there's not a whole lot of fuzziness in your rules or anything, right? I haven't heard anything negative about that. But I think there's like this culture of there's those companies who don't have funding to support themselves and they need a constant flow of money. And they can't wait 3 years to make something. And they have to have something new right now. And so they pick up the game in March and they kickstart it in December and it's out by next summer. And it can cause problems, I think.
And you don't have any idea that, I mean, you can do your research and do your best guess. When you're putting something in Kickstarter, you don't know what that demand is going to be. Yeah. And now there's this, like, sense that, like, you don't have a good campaign if you don't have stretch goals. Like, if you meet your goal ahead of time, if you don't throw another stretch goal up there, well, we're going to just take back our pledge because you owe us something, you know? So, so it's really difficult because then you're thinking, okay, we've got a few weeks left and people, you know, we want to keep this thing going. And this is expected, so then you're kind of doing stuff, you know, as you're going, saying so in my experience, having, you know, had to develop some things along the way of our Kickstarter with Great Heartland. Now, when I design a game, I know that my publisher friends are probably all going to use Kickstarter. So I'm thinking, what would be a stretch goal? What would be, what are some added value things? You know, some mini expansions I can be developing already. So I had the my game was almost completely done before it went on Kickstarter. So I my rules were written. I had another publisher that had already picked it up that it didn't work out, and I was able to get the rights back. So I had already kind of been through the development process once. I designed the game in 2009 initially, and when I saw it wasn't going anywhere, I was able to get the rights back and signed with Dice Hate Me, and then we started the process again. And when I thought it was absolutely done, because this was like third set of eyes on it. So don't get so excited about your idea that you haven't put the time in up front, and just expect that like the publisher's gonna take it and fix your problems and get it up. Because if they're rushing to get money together and rushing to get it out, then you're gonna miss something. Will get missed. So do your job. And then they really have to focus on their job. And
Two comments. I mean, the one on the stretch goals comment, it goes both ways. There are publishers who need money, but as Jason said, it's interesting. There is an economy. There's like sort of an economy that has been created in Kickstarter where there are expectations of stretch goals. There are expectations of free shipping. There are certain standards that have been set by the users, by the sellers. And now, and it's sort of scary because, like I wouldn't personally, like, if I were to self-publish something, I wouldn't use Kickstarter because, like, I'm not comfortable doing free domestic shipping. I'm not comfortable doing stretch goals, really. That's terrifying to me. And those things kill margins. A lot of publishers break even or lose money. Like, my publisher for Farmageddon, from the standpoint of what we did on Kickstarter, like, you obviously can't value the marketing benefit and those people, but he will lose money on the product for what Farmageddon did because we raised $25,000 when we were expecting to raise $5,000. People wanted something significant, and so he was like, okay, well, I'll do a free expansion. And thankfully, he said, that expansion has no time frame, and it's not out yet. We've actually just started the art, and this was, you know, it's been a year or so in development. So thankfully, I've had a very long time to develop what is a very simple expansion to make sure it's decent, but it's scary. And as for the testing and stuff, I mean, I worked on Farmageddon. Like, the core mechanic, like with Chevy with Scallywags, is pretty simple. And I think I got that down, like, two or three tests. But I worked on the cards for, like, 15 months. I've done, like, 80 tests of my war game. And, like, you could do this stuff. And, like, today I saw a balance problem. And, like, this stuff just takes time. And it takes years. And it takes so many different players. And it's just, you need to do blind testing with people. You need to send copies to people and be like, I need you to play this for, like, 3 months. Just when you get a chance. And give me your feedback. You need to go to cons like this and play with people. And it's just, if you're in a rush, you're probably going to make a mistake because it's just, think of all the ways people read language and how they interpret words. Like Chevy last night, I had three different interpretations for a card on the game that has like 12 words or something. It's not that crazy. I'm not using weird English. It's just that's how people process information. It's just, it's hard.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes left here, so I wonder if you guys can kind of give us your final best piece of advice for a first-time designer.
So I would say start simple. If you work on something really big, like you're going to make the pirate game, but it's space with a little bit of steampunk, there's this really cool time travel thing, that game will never get made. It's going to be terrible. It's going to cost you too much, and you're just going to be sad. I think for your first game, you should make something that's simple. Make a dice game. Make a card game. Learn how to incorporate theme. Learn how to play with the cards. Learn how to make a mechanic and a rule set. And just start to finish. Just go through it. It may not even be publishable. Don't even worry about it. Just make something. Make it simple. And you just have to finish it. Like, game designers are not people necessarily who, like, have ideas. It's game designers finish games. Whether they get published or not is a different thing, but game designers will finish the games. They treat it like work. They do it seriously. You don't have to do it like a second job, but finish something. Don't just start ideas and keep coming up with new ideas. Just pursue it. And if you don't have the discipline to finish a really small, simple game, then you're never going to finish the big one.
All right, so
top that.
Yeah. Watch this.
Like five things. Like you just,
yeah, like here's your one bit of
first piece of advice. This is the other person.
This has 5 points. This one point has 5 points.
point A.
It's all helpful stuff. What he said, but also here's my big one. I think about is be an emotionally healthy person.
Mm.
That's what you need to do to be a.
I think you just beat you.
Pat, I can
we'll be over here.
We'll go hide over here.
Game designers are people. The good ones. Are social, they have vision, they have great communication skills, they have great ideas, they have experience sometimes. If you come to them and you are a mess, your game could be awesome, but if they can have a normal conversation with a well-groomed, non-smelly human being, like, they're not going to work with you, right? So work with people that you want to be friends with. Be the kind of person that other people want to be friends with. And when people give you feedback, even if it's criticism, just call it feedback. And take it and listen. And don't be defensive. Be open. Because they're giving you a gift. And we get to do this really awesome thing. Like, you know, there's 40,000 people at Gen Con, and we have some games for sale at some of those booths, you know? And we're rich. We sort of paid for our gas to get here, you know? So this is an awesome opportunity we have. So every opportunity we have, you know, just be grateful for it, whether it's a good experience or not. And if you're not a together, healthy person that can handle stress and, like, communication, then... And you're a mess. So that's what I said.
What are your 9-1 things?
I only have one thing. The standard piece of advice is don't be afraid to fail. I'm going to take it the next level and say fail. Fail often. Fail every time. Because you're going to learn more from failing than you'll ever learn from succeeding. Fail every day. Make a new game every day that's complete garbage and throw it away and start over. Don't sit and dwell on something forever because it's just going to eat you up. Fail every single day because you will learn them. Most valuable lessons of your career from failure.
Careers pay money.
Cool. And failures are really just new game ideas, right? Like
it's a toolbox. Like my failure toolbox is where I dip into when something doesn't work. Like I need this isn't working. Oh crap! I tried this once before and it didn't work. Why don't I do it this way? And suddenly it works, you know? I dip into my failure toolbox all the time.
You need to create a website called My Failure Toolbox.
I might, actually.
That's actually my new emo band.
You took that from me. It's my new Flock of Seagulls cover band. My Failure Toolbox.
Well, guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us and for sharing all your thoughts and your experiences. We really appreciate it. Thank you all you guys for coming and hanging out with us. And that's what we got.
Thank you guys.
You gotta be emotionally healthy.
Listen to their podcast if you're interested,
so
too. It's gold for game designers.
It actually, it is, yeah.
Thank you.
They come up with ideas like every week.
We got an announcement.
Steal them all.
Which episode am I on?
They should listen to that.
It's not. Don't think about it. Go on my website.